Okay, today we conclude our five-part series on the Song of Solomon in parts 1 through 4. As you will remember, we took time to go over what you need to know when you read this book kind of material, all of which, at least in my mind, is quite important. And now for today, part 5, we will work through the book itself. We're going to read the whole thing. We're going to take it one verse at a time. Just kidding. All right. As we move through these 8 chapters, we obviously won't be able to address all the various details. My plan is to simply highlight some of the main points, offer explanations for tricky passages, and then try to follow the best that one can the loose storyline in this book, emphasis on loose. As you've been reading it, you have come to see that the Song of Solomon contains numerous statements that express how attractive the lovers are to each other. Often using comparisons and figures of speech that seem a bit strange to us. And we spent time on this in a previous sermon, and I offered some tips on how to make sense of those. And so today I won't be taking time to stop and analyze each and every one of those, which will, of course, save us a lot of time because there are a lot of them. And I also won't be taking time to explore the various arguments that scholars have when their interpretations of various passages differ. You may remember me commenting on this in previous weeks as well, that there's a whole range of opinions on how to approach this book and what certain passages mean, that sort of thing. So I'll just get into that if it seems significant, and then only briefly. And also, the book contains numerous statements that are figurative euphemisms for lovemaking or even particular body parts, male and female. And because the language is in Scripture, I can say with confidence that these figures of speech and metaphors themselves are not too explicit, but any attempt on my part to translate them would in some cases be too explicit. So I'll just kind of let those stand on their own without a whole lot of comment. And as a way of reminder, please note that this is love poetry. Again, it's not really a story per se. There is no actual man or woman here. These are simply figures in a love poem. And though there are story-like episodes in the Song of Solomon, there is no central plot. There's no grand climactic ending. And therefore, it is even a stretch to call it a fictional story. It is a song that contains fictional elements, but the composer is creating a poetic world. And that world is going to include a great deal of symbolism. And the purpose of it is to evoke both psychological and emotional exploration. And that is, poetry can help us to appreciate certain truths from a different perspective, and oftentimes help us to better understand such truths. And we looked at several examples of that in previous weeks. So before we start, let's begin with kind of a general overview of the book. At the very beginning of the Song of Solomon, it begins with these words, "Kiss me and kiss me again." And so we are instantly in the context of pretty intimate love. And all the images of gazelles and gardens and vineyards and trees and shepherds and royal possessions, they are all meant to convey the pleasure, the natural joy, and the glory of such intimate, the glory that such intimate love entails. The daughters of Jerusalem, we come across these a few times in the book, they assist us in bringing out these emotions, and they remind us of the poetic devices that are being used. And the daughters of Jerusalem is one such poetic device. For instance, there is no intention here on the part of the composer to have us to believe, even as a fiction, that these young maidens are engaged in conversations with the young woman in the bedroom of her wedding night. It's just far-fetched. So we have to keep reminding ourselves that though the composer is using fictional elements, the world he has created here is, again, a poetic one. Lots of things will be symbolic. Lots of things won't fit into the storyline. Also, in our general overview here, it would be good to point out that almost the whole book consists of songs between these two newly married lovers. And even most of those come from the young woman. And so we are primarily getting her perspective. That's kind of good to remember. So think again from what we talked about last week. The Song of Solomon, you give to your teenage girls. The Book of Proverbs, you give to your teenage boys. Because a lot of this is from the woman's perspective. She is madly in love with her lover, and he is madly in love with her. And he is the one that she surrenders her vineyard to, her virginity. And this because he is the one who has pledged himself to love her exclusively and permanently. And so this is a book that celebrates and enhances and really cements the significance and value and richness of marriage. So with that, let's open our Bibles and let's turn to the Song of Solomon. If you only have a phone, this may be a little hard for you to follow today. But again, we're not going to take the time to read the text. And hopefully you've read it several times in the past month. And hopefully you read it again last night. And it is relatively fresh in your mind. How many have been reading through the Song of Solomon, at least some, and you're kind of vaguely familiar, about half? Okay, good. All right, the other half, you guys can all leave at this point. So. Just kidding for those listening to the MP3. All right, depending on how you count them, we have here more or less a series of 30-some poems or short songs. Yet it is, as verse 1 indicates, a song, one song, and so this is a unity. One song that consists of many individual parts. We'll work through this one poem at a time, and some will require more attention than others. And with a few of these, we'll breeze through them rather quickly. And just one more thing here. I've been using both the NIV and the NLT in my own study of this book here in recent months. And so from the time, I'll refer to both and even jump back and forth between them. So hopefully that won't be too confusing. And regarding the divisions of these individual poems or songs, I'll be following, for the most part, what's laid out in the NLT, the New Living Translation. So, the first poem, a short one, runs from verse 2 to the last part of verse 4. Right away, we see the book opening up with strong and vibrant passion on the part of the woman, "Kiss me and kiss me again." Her aggressiveness here and elsewhere kind of undermines our stereotypes about romance in the ancient world. At least I would think it would. Women were not necessarily passive and subdued and docile. The young woman in the Song of Solomon is far from lifeless. She is passionate, exuberant, eager. She often takes the initiative. She speaks openly of her love for her lover. And when they are separated, she drops everything and actively pursues him, even putting her own safety and life at risk. In verse 3, the young woman speaks of her lover's reputation, that he is loved by all the young maidens, referring to the daughters of Jerusalem and others. And again, they serve as a role in the Song of Solomon. Here they highlight the good taste of the young woman herself. That is, she is not deluded here by what we'd call puppy love, because others would like to have her. They long to have her man as well, which confirms the quality of her choice. The referring to him as a king is also a poetic figure of speech. It's love language. In her eyes, he is a king. He's the best and most powerful man in her life, worthy of the highest honor. And a few verses later, he will be called a shepherd, but this isn't meant to be literal either. These are terms of endearment. In verse 4, the woman invites the man to come away with her, to escape, to flee, to run. She expresses her urgency. She is in a hurry to be intimate with her lover. And her song for yearning is satisfied. The first song of this book concludes with her in his bedroom. And so contrary to what some might expect, the book does not start off soft and slow and builds to something more intense. It's pretty intense right at the very beginning. The last part of poem 2 would be the last part of verse. The last part of verse 4 is a separate song sung by the daughters of Jerusalem. So this is just a short poem there in the middle, verse 4. They affirm the young woman's happiness, and in that they affirm her as well, that she is a worthy recipient of this man's love and adoration. The next poem runs from the end of verse 4 to 7. The young woman sings to her lover again. She begins by affirming the praise the daughters of Jerusalem has for him, but then the mood changes. She pauses and takes a moment to describe herself and more or less apologizes for her appearance. She complains that her skin is dark due to the fact that she has been burned by the sun while caring for the vineyards of her brothers. And of course, cultures vary when it comes to the beauty of suntans. Americans find them attractive. But in the ancient world, a suntan indicated that you belong to the lower class. those who labored outdoors in the sun, rather than the privileged upper class who had servants to do that kind of thing for you. And so burned skin was not considered a thing of beauty. She tries to explain that her brothers forced her into this because they were angry with her. Nonetheless, she closes her song with somewhat of a tease. She wants a rendezvous with her lover and asks where he is taking his flocks for rest at noon, presumably so that they can dally together alone while the animals feed. She asks for directions so that she doesn't have to go poking around for him from shepherd tent to shepherd tent, looking like some kind of prostitute or loose woman out soliciting available guys. We now hear for the first time in poem number 4 from the man, and this runs from verse 8 to 11. She initiates, and now he responds, but his words read like a playful, sensual game of hide and seek. His coy response is probably intended to arouse deeper desire in her. Both parties in this book often play hard to get at times. He does not tell her the location. Instead, he gives her a strategy for finding him. Follow the trail of my sheep as they wander out into the wilderness. And the young man now describes the effects that she has on him, comparing her to a mare among Pharaoh's stallions. Now, to us, this might seem like a really strange way to compliment a woman. But several things are going on here. Such mares would have been, of course, the best of the best, beautiful and majestic. But in addition to this, we would want to note that horses used to drive chariots were usually stallions, not mares. Stallions were unneutered, adult male horses used for breeding. And to refer to her as a male, as a mare among stallions, is to describe the effect, the excitement that she stirs in men. Apparently, there is this strategy in ancient wars where a mare would be let loose into an approaching army of chariots, and the stallions would then chase the mare instead of running into the battle. And so to paraphrase the thought here of the young man, he is essentially saying that his lover drives all the men crazy with her attractiveness, including himself. All right, let's now pick it up with let's now pick up the pace a little bit and look at the next 4 poems together, which are all quite short, verse 12 to the second verse of chapter 2. In the first poem, sung by the young woman, it is obvious that she is in the man's intimate presence. Then in his song to her, he calls her beautiful and compares her eyes to doves, probably referring to their softness or possibly their tranquility. She then responds in the next poem, calling him handsome beyond words, and then we are given a picture into where this intimate setting is taking place. Not in a bedroom, but in a forest where there is a small grassy opening. They are surrounded by trees, which provides privacy, and these particular trees, cedar, produce a pleasant scent, making this spot an ideal place for an intimate encounter. Her poem ends with another humble self-description. She compares herself to one of the countless flowers growing on the plain of Sharon. That is to say, she is just one of many girls and that there's nothing special about her at all, nothing unique, just another lily of the valley. On a side note, the traditional translation found in the King James, I am the rose of Sharon, cannot possibly be the intended meaning here, as roses did not come into Israel until after the Old Testament period. The young man in the next poem, just one verse there, responds to this humble assessment of herself, assuring her that all the flowers and lilies are thorns and thistles in comparison. She is the only one worth looking at. Again, his love is exclusive, and he is not distracted by others. And here we see again yet another example of him being a one-woman man. Now for the 9th poem, which is rather lengthy. It consists of 11 verses, and we'll start with verse 3. Where it starts there in verse 3 of chapter 2. Several things take place in this particular love poem. First, she responds to him, calling her a lily among thorns, by calling him the best apple tree in the orchard. And also, she speaks of him taking her to the banquet hall. The Hebrew is better translated, has taken me to the house for drinking wine. Again, this is poetic language to refer to the intoxicating effect his love has on her. The second part of this verse in the NIV reads, "His banner over me is love," which of course reminds us of that popular children's Sunday school song. Different translations render that differently. Essentially, the young man has marked her out as his own and has stamped her with a public display of his love. And the metaphor, "his banner over me is love," implies belonging, inclusion, and commitment. In the next verse, we see that the intensity of her love is making her physically weak. She is exhausted and calls for raisin cakes and apples. And she goes on to speak of his intimate embrace there in verse 6. And now we find in verse 7 the first exhortation given to the daughters of Jerusalem. The young woman is being held by her lover and yet calls out to her friends, "Do not awaken love until the time is right." And we find this advice, instruction, urging three times in this book. And last week we spent some time explaining what it means and its significance to the Song of Solomon. She calls on her friends, young maidens, to remain chaste, patience, then passion. Wait for the one who will pledge himself to you, the one who will love you exclusively and permanently. In verses 8 through 13, the scene changes to that of celebrating the arrival of her lover. We see him leaping over the mountains and bounding over the hills. And this, of course, is a poetic way of saying that he is in a hurry to meet up with her. He calls out to her and invites her to come away with him. He appeals to her by pointing out that winter is now past and spring has arrived. Springtime, of course, is the universal time for love. Warmer weather, the fragrance of flowers, a time to be outside in nature, away from the city, into the country, where they can enjoy their love in fresh air and privately. Again, these verses are poetic language designed to evoke a sense of newness, vigor, freshness, joy, expectation, all a context for joyous lovemaking. The 10th poem is only one verse, verse 14. It seems that the young woman is now the one playing hard to get, hiding behind the rocks under a cliff on the mountainside. He calls on her to show her face and to let her voice be heard. The next poem, number 11, is a bit strange and on the surface seems somewhat perplexing, but really isn't. Most translations attribute the short song more like a chorus to the daughters of Jerusalem. What we have here are certain foxes loose in the vineyard destroying the fruit. Elsewhere in the Song of Solomon, the vineyard represents the woman's sexuality or even lovemaking. In either case, the presence of foxes imposes a threat to this. And in this context, it seems that the daughters of Jerusalem are telling the young woman that her playing hard to get at this point by hiding behind the rocks could very well backfire. The grapevines are blossoming. The time is short. Don't risk losing this opportunity. All right, with poem 12, I'll be following the NIV designation here that begins with verse 16 of chapter 2 and goes all the way to the end of chapter 3. There seems to be three parts to it. In verses 16 through 17, she affirms her mutual affection and uses the language of ownership. She belongs to him and he belongs to her. And then in the opening verse of chapter 3, there appears to be an abrupt change. Her lover is now missing, and out of desperation, she goes out looking for him, but has no luck. She searches the city streets, but nothing. She then encounters the city guards, and they've not seen her either. But then she finds him and holds on to him and won't let go. She then takes him to her mother's house, to the very bedroom where she was conceived. And it is obvious what she has in mind. These four verses have some similarities to another passage in chapter 5, and the two are believed to be connected in some way. And no doubt you saw this in your own reading. Hopefully you've been reading this, because today is going to be kind of a scrambled mess if you're not at least familiar with the storyline somewhat. We have in both of these passages some similarities. The two lovers are separated. She goes out looking for him into the streets, and in each of those she encounters the guardians of the city. Here, she finds her lover, but in chapter 5, she doesn't. Here, the guardians are not hostile, but in chapter 5, they strip off her veil and beat her up. All this presents quite a challenge. How are these two episodes related? And how does any of this contribute to the love between this couple that drives the whole book? Well, some have suggested that both passages are dreams. Others have argued that there's much symbolism going on here, and that the symbolic interpretation is intriguing and seems to answer a lot of questions, but it raises other questions as well. So I can't really take time this morning to delve into this too much, but if it is symbolism, the city guards, the watchmen, would probably represent the commitment that she has had all her life to guard and protect her virginity. And these two episodes describe figuratively the range of emotions and anxieties and misgivings that are swirling inside her. She wants to give herself to her beloved. She loves him to that extent, yet she knows that once she does surrender it, she can't get it back, and so she feels a conflict. And this is just one of many things that are going on there symbolically. So these particular verses here where we are at now in chapter 3 seem simple enough, but they certainly appear to be related to the passage in chapter 5. And if so, then it becomes a challenge to figure out what is going on and what it all means. So it could be a dream, it could be symbolic, or it might be just part of the story itself. The jury is still out on this, and just don't know. But back to verse 4, they are both, to come back and complete that thought, they are both here in her mother's bed, and at this moment of intimacy, she calls out to the daughters of Jerusalem with that noted exhortation, wait for this, what I am enjoying, you can enjoy as well, but wait for it, wait for the one who will pledge himself to you. Patience, then passion. Now, one has to wonder why, of all places, she would take him there. It certainly doesn't seem like the ideal romantic spot. You know, where do you want to go for your honeymoon? Well, how about my parents' house? I bet they'll even let us use their bed. You know, it's just the whole thing is a little weird and creepy. So if I ever do the extended version of the Song of Solomon series, which I probably won't, but if I were to, we could look into that. But the language here could very well be figurative, and I'll just leave it at that for now. All right, the third part of her song is quite interesting, and again, there is no general consensus about among scholars about what is going on. She now describes this scene where Solomon is spotted from afar, coming across the desert, stirring up a cloud of smoke. And as he gets closer, his majestic carriage and mighty army becomes visible. When he finally arrives, it is noted that Solomon's presence is refreshing, like the presence of myrrh and frankincense. And his carriage, it is noted, is built from the best wood the world knows, imported from Lebanon. Its posts are silver, its cushions are purple. Inside are engraved decorations of love scenes. The armies that surround him are Israel's best soldiers, the most skilled swordsmen and warriors. Solomon himself is wearing a crown, the very crown his mother gave him for the wedding day. So there are a lot of explanations for this. I'm going to offer the two that I consider to be the best. Maybe Solomon is provided in the story as a character that the young woman can compare her lover with. Solomon has all this fame and wealth and power and so much to offer, but even so, that even all that is not enough to distract her. She herself is now a one-man woman, and she would take her lover, simple and poor that he may be, over even Solomon himself. He is not a distraction. Or another possibility is that she is simply expressing her imagination about her lover as she reflects on the wonders of him and marriage to him. He is to her as great and majestic and awe-inspiring as Solomon himself. So it could go either way. All right, the next poem is quite long and takes almost the whole fourth chapter, but we don't need to spend a lot of time on it. The young man once again expresses how beautiful she is to him, but in this song he is more descriptive and specific. He finds great delight in her hair, teeth, lips, cheeks, neck, breasts, and concludes that part of it with, "You are altogether beautiful, my darling, beautiful in every way." And yet again, he calls on her to come away with him, and she has, he says, captured his heart, and she has, he says, captured his heart and holds it hostage with just a glance of her eyes. Now, the invitation here is not to a place, but as we will see in the coming verses, it is an invitation to once again share in the act of love. He will not force himself on her. He simply invites her and hopes that she will give herself willingly. He goes on to describe his intense love for her and speaks of not just her beauty, but also of her sweet aroma. So as you read this chapter, you can feel his excitement grow with each verse. And at the end of the song, he compares her to both a garden and a fountain. Beautiful, refreshing, joyous, delicious, sweet. But yet this garden is locked and this fountain is sealed. That is, she is not public. She belongs only to him. The next three poems, 14, 15, and 16, are short and all related to the same event, and so we will deal with them together. In verse 16, the young woman responds to this invitation. She calls on the north and south winds to arouse love in her beloved. Again, poetic language, and responds to his invitation by inviting him. In verse 1 of chapter 5, the young man responds. The poetry is discreet and restrained. It conveys the joy of sexual love without vulgarity. At the same time, the meaning is quite clear. The catalog of luxuries here, garden, myrrh, honey, wine, and so on, imply that he has partaken of her pleasures to the fullest. And in the second part of verse 2, the daughters of Jerusalem call on both lovers to let themselves be intoxicated with love. Again, they are not barging into their bedroom singing such a chorus. This is simply a poetic device used to affirm the beauty and purity and wholeness of God's good gift. The 17th poem begins with verse 2 and extends down to verse 8. I dealt with this a couple weeks ago and jokingly commented that I wouldn't have to deal with it again today, but I don't think I can just skip over it. So I'll summarize again the episode, offer just a couple comments, and then direct you back to the previous sermon on July 22nd. We have here an episode that is difficult to make sense of, and this is the one that has some similarities to that passage in chapter 3 that we just talked about. It's believed to be related. Immediately after the marital act, we find that the young lover is now, for some unknown reason, outside, knocking on the door, calling on his young bride, calling on her to let him into the house. She is hesitant because she has retired for the night. He tries to unlatch the door himself, and this stirs in her a certain excitement. And so she goes to the door and happily opens it up for him, but he is no longer there. He is taken off. Her heart sinks, and she heads out to search for him all over town, but he's nowhere to be found. The night watchmen, in making their rounds, encounter the young woman out on the streets. And instead of helping her find her lover or escort her back home to safety, they beat her up to the point of bruising her. And as we come to the end of the episode, the male lover is still missing, and we don't know where he is or why he left. Now, there are a lot of whys here that are hard to answer, and most explanations I've read about regarding these six verses are, most of them are pretty doable until you get to what they say about the night watchman beating her up. I've not found a satisfying explanation to that. The only one that I found is that the attack is symbolic, and not just the attack, but also this business about the lover being missing and her searching for him and all the interaction at the door and so on. It's all symbolic. And 2 weeks ago, I explained some of this. But again, even a symbolic approach raises additional problems. And so I really don't have a good explanation to offer you about verses 2 through 7. So if you want your money back this morning, I guess we can give it back to you, because I'm lost on that. Essentially, there is a separation. She goes out looking for him. He's nowhere to be found. She calls on her friends, the daughters of Jerusalem, to promise her, if you find my lover, tell him I am weak with love. And that itself is pretty interesting. She's not weak from getting beaten up. She is weak from lovesickness. All right, with that, we'll move on to the next poem. The next two poems, numbers 18 and 19, starting with verse 9 of chapter 5, the daughters of Jerusalem ask the young woman, what makes this lover of yours worth all that trouble? Why is he so special? And so she answers that in verses 10 through 16. And her answer is clear enough. She is captivated by his physical appearance. She is quite descriptive and compares him to the best of the best. She praises his hair, his head, his eyes, his cheeks, his lips, his mouth, his arms, his abdomen, his legs, his posture, and so on. She calls him radiant and dazzling, outstanding among 10,000. Let's now take the next two poems together. Each are short, Numbers 20 and 21. In verse 1 of chapter 6, the daughters of Jerusalem respond to the young woman with yet another question. Where has your lover gone? We want to help you. Which way did he go? And she answers them in verses 2 and 3. And the answer is a bit of a mystery. He has gone down to his garden. In other words, he is with me. And this is confirmed by the statement of ownership and commitment in verse 3. I am my lover's and he is mine. So apparently he hasn't been missing at all. Apparently he has been with her the whole time. Or maybe he just at that moment arrived. I mean, I don't know. Or maybe she just felt as though he had abandoned her, which plays into the symbolic interpretation that we looked at. He left her emotionally, or she feared that he left her emotionally. Just now, again, not really sure what's going on. All right, poem number 22. This starts at verse 4 and runs down to verse 10. Here the young man sings about how her beauty has captivated him. Many of these descriptions are the same or similar to ones we've looked at earlier or that he has used earlier. And as typical in the Song of Solomon, a lover will describe the other lover by comparing him or her to the best of the best. Here, her beauty is so overpowering that it arouses fear as well as joy, as seen in verse 4. Let's take the next two poems together, number 23 and 24. Both are short. The best explanation for verses 11 and 12 is that the young woman is recounting her experience. The setting is the countryside, a setting that is, in this book, associated with intimacy. It is also springtime, the season for love. According to scholars, verse 12 is the most difficult passage in the book to translate. No one really knows exactly what it means. And because it's not crucial to our understanding of the book, we won't take time to delve into that whole discussion. In verse 13, the daughters of Jerusalem call on the young woman to return. We don't know where she went or to where she's being called to return to. That might be clear, more clear if we had a good understanding of verse 12, but again, we don't. But regardless, the emotions being expressed are clear enough. The daughters of Jerusalem long to be with her as they come to realize that they are now losing her to her beloved. The young woman has passed through the rite of becoming a married woman, both physically and emotionally, and is no longer really one of them, one of the girls. All right, poem number 25. 6:13 to 7:9, the young man again praises the beauty of his lover, and we find here descriptions we've not found before. He now speaks of how attractive her feet are, her thighs, navel, belly, neck, breasts, eyes, nose, head, and so on. And as you read it, you get the strong sense that he cannot hold himself back. He is so captivated by her beauty, and he openly expresses his deepest longings. The next poem, number 26, for the second part of verse 9 all the way to verse 4 of chapter 8, belongs to the young woman. She appears to interrupt him when he begins to compare a kiss to wine, and she more or less completes his thought. And unlike what we saw in chapter 2, where at one point she seemed to be playing hard to get, here, when he expresses his desire for her, she interrupts him and assures him that she is his. And here, she is the one who invites him to come out with her to the fields and spend the night among the wild flowers. There, she says, I will give you my love. Her love for him is so intense that she complains about not being able to kiss him in public. The verses there at the beginning of chapter 8 seem a bit strange to us. Apparently, in the ancient world, the only public kissing allowed for a young woman would be that with a father or brother, and just a short kiss of affection. A kiss given to a husband would suggest more than affection and would indicate that that there was a desire for something more erotic. And so public kissing among married couples was inappropriate. Verses 2 and 3 therefore express her desire to show him her love privately, since it can't be expressed publicly. And then in verse 4, which, like the others, is strategically placed, is the exhortation to the daughters of Jerusalem to have patience. And this, of course, is the third time now that she's called on her friends to exercise patience, to remain chaste. All right, poems 27 and 28, we'll take them together. In verse 5, the daughters of Jerusalem have changed the focus of their attention from the young man now to the young woman. She is now the object of their admiration and perhaps even envy. They observe her leaning on her lover, a picture of security, dependence, affection, trust. It appears that the couple is now leaving the wilderness, the place of intimacy, to return to the grind of everyday life. And so this verse seems to represent a change in direction, you might say, in this book. From here to the end, it is not so much a story of them pursuing each other and running off to make love together, but rather that of reflection. In the next poem, starting in the second part of verse 5, the young woman recalls a particular moment under the apple tree, a precious moment, and spends time reflecting on the power of love. And verses 6 and 7 are the most memorable and intense of the entire book. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love, rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all the wealth of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned. She expresses her belief that her desire to hold on to the man and his desire to have him hold on to her is as inescapable as the grave itself. Also, love is like a fire that cannot be put out, regardless of how much water is used to drench it. It will burn and continue to burn and burn and burn. And it is more powerful than, of course, even money. Money will bring many things, but not love, and even trying to buy it will only result in shame. All right, Poem 29 stands out as unique, for here we have a party that we first heard about in chapter 1, but we've not heard anything of them since, and now they have something to say at the end of the book, and this would be the brothers of the young woman. They refer to another sister, a younger one, who has not yet come of age, but soon will. As brothers, they are concerned about her purity, and they take responsibility to guard it. Being a wall here does not refer to being flat-chested. It refers to staying a virgin. A wall is clearly designed to keep people out. In verse 9, the image of the wall is contrasted with the image of a door, which represents promiscuity. So, as in keeping with ancient traditions, the brothers make it their mission to protect their sister's virginity, making sure that she saves herself until marriage, as noted in verse 8. Building up and strengthening the wall and blocking the door are poetic images used to describe their efforts. In poem 30, verses 10 through 12, the young woman herself now chimes in about all of this. Without hesitation, she asserts the fact, kind of even brags, it seems, that even though she had come of age some time ago, she had guarded her virginity and kept herself pure for her beloved. This fact highlights the last part of verse 10, which in the NLT reads, "When my lover looks at me, he is delighted in what he sees." He is delighted, of course, because as stated all through the Song of Solomon, she is beautiful. But here, he is delighted because she has saved herself for him. And what is being described here takes very little imagination. Brothers protecting their little sister. We can see that. And the older sister here using the opportunity to kind of flaunt her virtues as she admonishes her younger sister to follow her example. In verse 11, the young woman then somewhat abruptly goes into this thing about where she seems to be kind of mocking Solomon. But probably what's going on here is that she is continuing with her sisterly advice and is still involved in a little bit of boasting. But none of this boasting seems out of place. All of it is quite appropriate given what is at stake. So to paraphrase it, verses 11 and 12 might go something like this. I kept myself pure. My vineyard is mine, and I am in control of it. I decide who to give it to and when and how. No one could have convinced me otherwise. No one could have bought that from me, not even Solomon himself. And again, there is also the sense that Solomon is kind of being put down a little bit. His harem is so, you can kind of hear her say, his harem is so large, hundreds of wives and concubines, and really, what does he have? What does he really have? I'll tell you what he has, an overindulgence of cheap and meaningless sex, What he doesn't have is what I and my beloved share, which is far greater than all his sexual hookups and wealth and power and fame and all the rest. I am much richer than he will ever be. And this is yet another place in the Song of Solomon where exclusive, devoted sexual love against polygamy and promiscuity is upheld and supported. All right, let's now finish up by looking at the last two poems, Numbers 31 and 32, which would be verses 13 and 14. The Song of Solomon ends on the same note that it opened up with, songs of yearning. Here in the midst of a crowd of companions, he calls out to her. She responds with an invitation to come away with her, to once again escape. Let us go to the, where? Does it say in your Bibles? Who's still following with me? To the mountains. To the mountains of spices. Guess it depends what version you're using. Let us join together in the privacy of our love. And let us do so quickly. Let us go to the mountains of spices. So the book ends abruptly. There is no grand climactic ending, but it is a happy ending nonetheless. There is no real conclusion because the song is not really done. Love is not done. The composer meant to leave us with asking what's going to happen next. So throughout this book, there is leaving and returning, separation and reunion, yearning and receiving, and then yearning again. And this is how the song ends. Love more delightful than wine. Yearning, receiving, and yearning again. So with that, our series on the Song of Solomon concludes. Next week, we'll have not just a change of subjects, but also a change of speakers as well. It'll be Tom Detmer's turn. Do you know what you're doing next week?
Ephesians 2.
All right, good. So should we be reading ahead? All right. If you send me that as an email, then I'll send it out so people can be reading it. Hopefully they will. Hopefully they'll do that. So, all right. At this time, I'm going to have Steve come, and he's going to close our service.